Hey, folks, it's Spoiler in Time, the show that Cord Killers allows us to do. Because on the show Cord Killers, our other show, we talk about all the stuff you need to watch stuff. Then we watch it. We talk about it here on Spoiler in Time. I'm Tom Merritt.
Hey, man, I'm Brian Brushwood, and none of you care about us. You care about how the movie draft is doing. Also, there's a thing called the movie draft.
It's fun. Hey, we're winning, Brian.
Sure. This is the nice thing. I liked it better when between you and me and Team Cord Killers, we had half the slate so that we could always claim that we were winning. But
we
now,
are.
Team Cord Killers, which is not our team,
Malongo,
is
Chris
in number
Cates.
One. Yeah. Sorry, I got distracted. 412, man, with still The Greatest Showman coming out. But I think even if The Greatest Showman makes $100 million, it's not going to be enough.
Yeah, I don't see The Greatest Showman making $100 million, but it's Christmas time. Who knows? I do feel like that last Heyday, how do you say it? Probably has a shot.
Wait, which one?
The last Yeti. The last Yeti.
Yeti. The last Yeti.
I just realized what you're saying, sir.
By the way, you know what? I totally forgot until just this second that I saw The Shape of Water in preview.
Wait, you did?
Yeah.
How was it?
It was great.
Yeah.
I mean, wow. You wouldn't think so
great.
Since I totally forgot I saw it. but I was captivated. I was fascinated with it. Team Big and Tall has that. That's the movie that's coming out this week. And it's really good. I like a Guillermo del Toro style movie no matter what. But this was just real tight, and it's got this kind of cool nostalgia vibe because it takes place in an alternate 50s era, with, you know, they're fighting against the Ruskies, the Soviets. But it's just a great love story.
So Coco enjoyed the number one spot for a second week in a row, and yet is only at $108 million. That seems so low for a Pixar movie of this quality. Do you think it
for
was
a Pixar movie leading the box office 2 weeks in a row? Now, granted, one of those weeks is Thanksgiving weekend, so maybe that's part of it, but it's just a low, low box office season. It really is. I mean, Kingsman finally did crest $100 million, which I think is crazy that it's still actually making money this late into the season, but Thor Ragnarok hasn't hit $300 million. Justice League hasn't broken $200 million. Those will both break those marks next week, but what's really weird is to look at this objectively and say, oh, well, Coco is overperforming if you compare it to every other movie this fall.
Yeah, that's hard to say out loud, but I think you're right.
Yeah. Like, if you just look at the numbers rather than the expectations, it's really, really weird.
Yeah, that's astonishing. And also, is Disaster Artist in limited release right now?
It is.
$1 million seems very low.
I believe it's wide release this Friday.
Okay, great.
I wanted to go see it because I had seen people are going to see it. And
have you seen The Room?
Of course I've seen The Room.
I've only seen a few snippets here and there, and I don't know that I want to subject myself to watching all of The Room. Now, granted, I do know that it will enhance The Disaster Artist.
You should see The Room with people.
Yes,
like that's the thing about The Room is it's an event.
It's a party game.
Yeah,
we were going to go see it.
It's an endurance party game.
Yeah. We were going to go see it at UCLA, where they had a midnight showing. Sold out.
Wow.
Sold out for weeks.
Yeah, by the way,
all the previous stuff I'm hearing about it is like you got to go see it.
This is one of the Disaster Artist or The Room, Tom.
The Room.
Yeah. Okay.
Weeks before The Disaster Artist came out was sold out.
I think that is, I don't want to use the word genius with Tommy Wiseau. However, it is a very challenging thing to swallow one's pride to do the financially better thing for your project. And I think Tommy Wiseau astutely realized I will be a punching bag. I will be Ed Wood. However, I will also be realizing my dream of having a significant piece of film history.
I mean, it's interesting because I think The Room's cult status already achieves that on some level.
Well, not compared to what's about to happen. Like, he's about to make more money, and because he self-financed the room, right?
Yeah.
So it's like he's about to make an insane amount of money. Mm-hmm. And it's because he doesn't mind being, forgive me for saying the clown, you know, he doesn't mind being the target of all the laughter. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. No, he's about to make a lot of money. You're absolutely right. All right, let's move on and talk about Mr. Robot, episode 8 of season 3. Brian, I don't remember anything about this episode.
You know why you didn't? Because it wasn't plugged in to the greater story that we've seen. Instead, this entire episode was about Elliot getting his head right. We begin with Elliot about to commit suicide. We see him make a drug deal to buy an insane amount of, what did he call it, morphe?
Morphe, like, yeah, I know that too.
Which, by the way, I bet that might be a standards and practices dodge they made, because they don't ever name any of the drugs because it's probably illegal or probably against
standards. Well, but some of them were like, we got benzes, we got dex. I'm like, oh, okay, I've heard those. I've never heard morphe.
Well, they say Xannies. I've never heard Xanax called Xannies. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not out shopping as often as I used to. So,
but my point is, we see him on the precipice of deep, deep despair after the frame job being made against his colleagues and friends and former members of F Society, and about how all of this is about to be swept under the rug. Oh, it's an Iran thing or whatever. And this episode, we're watching Elliot seeking peace, and we see him disturbed with this memory of his father at the movie theater. We see him go to the houses of people where everybody's turned against them. They're all like, I don't know what's going on. You know, get out of here. All of a sudden we're targets for.
Well, I really like the fact that he was, you know, part of his suicide mission, right? Is I will go and I will make amends for those who died in a place where I should have. And he gets two different reactions. One is, like you're saying, anger, get out of here. And the other is, why? Why did this happen? She was a good girl.
Yeah. And we get a little bit of, with that kid, they dangle the possibility that the kid is a figment of his imagination. And they deliberately set that up with the fact that we're remembering him as a kid with Mr. Robot. And so all of a sudden there's a kid around the same age at the same theater and so on.
Who appears out of nowhere on the beach.
Right.
Like, yeah.
But then they very deliberately make it clear he's a real human being. And
do they?
Yeah.
I mean, well, I think you're right. But if they wanted to, they could still say he wasn't there.
They could, but
all he does is open the door. I mean, that's
no. Because you remember they're at the movie theater, and then the kid disappears, and he leaves, and he says to the cashier, "You see a kid with a hoodie?"
You're right.
He's like, "Yeah, no, he bounced." And then, like in that moment, remember what I said I've been wanting from the show was just a little bit of stability before we get drifty again. And I feel like I got it. I got a genuine interaction between Elliot dealing with the massive guilt about everything that's happening around him. And it happened with another human being in a way that was really grounded and concrete and also unified with the themes we've seen before, because this is not the first time we've seen Back to the Future referenced, and now we're seeing it again. And I like the fact that they grounded this story in specific times, none of which is our current day. There's the opening scene in the 90s where the background marquees say Babe, Pig in the City, and so on. And then there's the current time where it's very deliberately November 15th, 2015. So a couple years ago that this happened. I think it was the 15th, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or November 2nd or whatever it was.
Also a very like casual drop of like the Wii U.
Yes. Right. Exactly. Exactly. I loved how grounded this was from beginning to end.
Sure. It's a great episode. This is going to be a refrain you've heard me say on Spoiler in Time before. Really great episode, really well told, didn't get me anywhere. And I'm starting to get a little bit tired of that. But again, it may all pay off. I may need every one of these bricks that is being put in the wall here to actually have a wall at the end. And I'm willing to still hang in for that. That set aside, I'm with you that I loved that. You know, we basically got a snippet of writer's room dialogue when they're waiting in line for Back to the Future. You know, it's more complex than that. It's a story about how you have to go into the future to change the past. And someone else is like, no, it's simpler than that. And I'm like, this is what it sounds like when writers are trying to figure out how to explain something. Like, I feel like this was taken straight out of that. And the only other thing I want to add to what you said, because I think you beautifully summarized this episode, is that flashback with Elliot and his dad really it showed off a little bit of the acting chops, but really showed that his dad was not Mr. Robot. His dad lacked a little confidence, was a little bit unsure that he's doing the right thing with Elliot.
That's a really good point. I don't think I picked that up at the time. There's his dad, and then there's Mr. Robot, and the two are very different. Wow.
Just put the M&Ms in there and eat it, kid. We're going inside. He's not like, oh, come on, Elliot, you know, it works. Let me try to, you know, get you cheered up. Like it wasn't so different that it wasn't believable. Right. But there was a difference there.
And this was also not long after Elliot was pushed out the window. Right.
I mean, it was right.
Oh,
after.
That's part of the reason he's so apologetic or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe that explains why he's off his cut. Because we've seen him with a ton of confidence before in other flashbacks.
Did you guys get as much joy as I did out of the different iterations of all the cosplay characters that people were doing for that performance? Like not only did you have your Doc Browns and your Marty McFlys, but I love the person who was dressed as the clock tower being struck by lightning. Like, did you catch that one? It was so great.
No, I think I missed that one. That's great.
I adored it, and I was left feeling more stable. And it was a great return to form. You know, he showed up. Think about X-Files, right? Yes, we all wanted the episodes about the black goo and about the secret Cold War between the Russians and the U.S. using alien technology or whatever. But there were some really good Monster of the Week episodes during X-Files' times. And in this case, we got to see just straight up, you know, he shows up. And you know, we feel wronged by that guy's brother calling him a terrorist. And we got to see Elliot use his superpowers just like he did in the beginning. Like, sorry, it's not personal. I hack everyone. Also, you're going to give a decent funeral to your brother. And we're done. I enjoyed all of that.
I mean, it's a Monster of the Week episode in that Elliot's suicidal thoughts are the monster.
Correct. Correct.
But that's, I don't know. It doesn't feel the pleasure of a Monster of the Week episode is black oil's over there. We're going to focus on this entirely different thing. And this is still tied into everything else, just not bringing us any progress, which I still find a little frustrating.
Yeah, fair enough.
We also got a little bit of world building between walking past the National Guard detention camp. Did you know
that? Yes. Oh, yeah. No. This was a substantial thing. We've already seen the trash building up in the background. Now we're seeing militaristic dictatorship-like control. I love the constant drone of curfews and coupons and whatnot.
Yeah. All the monuments for the 71?
For 7-Eleven? No, it's not 7-Eleven.
No, the 71 locations of E-Corp that were blown up.
Yeah. The purple
ribbon.
I'll tell you what, I wouldn't mind seeing them go a little bit farther off the rails either way. I think at this point I'm fully bought in. Oh my God. That last scene with him talking to Angela.
Through the door.
Acting job that Portia Doubleday does, losing her mind, crying like, you know, I'm convinced that they had a psychologist on set to walk her through some deeply painful memories. And you see Rami Malek do a really convincing crying job. Like, I'm convinced that they had somebody there to walk them through deeply personal experiences to actually start crying on camera, because I believed all of it. Made me deeply moved.
I mean, that's what a method actor can do, right?
Okay, well, hang on. Don't you start me on that.
Sorry, no, I shouldn't go for the easy cheap shot there, because you're absolutely right. I would not be surprised with that either. That dredged up some pretty primal emotions for both of them, for sure.
Yeah, I think this episode, I needed this episode in a way I don't think you guys did. I've been teetering on the edge of backing away, but this one really brought me back because it just focuses on the core fundamentals. And I'm not going to lie, as soon as we're done, you know, you guys are going to leave. Bonnie and I watched it without Bonnie. I'm going to watch it again with Bonnie. I think we're going to enjoy it.
Very cool. All right, let's move on to Deadwood, episode 2 of season 1, and we are in the town. It's basically Swearingen figuring out what he needs to do to stop the little girl from waking up and causing trouble.
Yeah, this is a bit of cleanup from the previous episode. First episode, and again, second episode really made me appreciate how many things they accomplished in the first. You know, they had some kind of story, narrative thing of the week to have happen on top of all the character establishment that they've done. They hinted that Al Swearingen is the boss of the town and that he's worth being scared of and so on. And I think they showed him disposing of a body or whatever. But with the straight up murder that happens at the end of this one and the fact that you see such convincing acting mere seconds before he just whips out that knife and stabs that dude and then walks outside wiping his hands and says, "Hey, come on up, bring the sled." And the world weary way in which the guys respond, like, "Oh, this again."
The pigs are full. They're not going to eat anymore at this point.
It was great. This is and plus also we're starting to see that, that what looked like a throwaway scene in the first episode where it's like, oh, Al Swearingen engages in scams and cons and sells useless land or whatever. Now
cheap
we're seeing
cons,
like
swindles and tricks.
Exactly. It's not just that he does that. Now we're seeing like, oh, no. The story is he sold it to this guy and this guy may not be okay with how things are turning out. And you sort of catch the beginning of this brewing, like, well, that's not going to go away anytime soon.
Well, not only that, but he has got a drug dependent wife who played Jackie on House of Cards upstairs, who's kind of a wild card because the doc is starting to get tired of feeding her habit.
I'm ashamed to admit that I couldn't figure out where I'd seen her before. Thank you for pointing out that it was Jackie, because I kept trying to make her the Salverson proxy. What's her name? That it doesn't matter.
Sheriff Salverson.
Yeah. Okay. No. But it's not even Sheriff Salverson. It's the one that the following season replaced.
Yeah.
Her.
No. I know. She's not sheriff.
And
anymore,
she was also
right.
in The Leftovers. Carrie Coons. Yeah. Carrie Coons. I kept trying to make it Carrie Coons.
Right.
And it
right.
wasn't.
There's a similarity there. I could see that. Also, Nick Offerman. Gets offed in this episode by Wild Bill Hickok.
I did not realize that was Nick Offerman.
I didn't either till I was looking up Jackie. I'm in IMDb, like, who is that? I know I recognize her. And then I see Nick Offerman. I'm like, Nick Offerman wasn't in this episode. And then I look up who he is. I'm like, holy, that was him.
That's amazing. I adored. Capital adored. I'm not going to spell the word adored. I loved that last scene where I'm going to have to learn her name eventually. What's the name of the shouting drunk girl with Wild Bill?
Oh, Calamity Jane.
What's that?
Calamity Jane.
Oh, shoot. That's Calamity Jane.
Yeah. They just call her Jane all the time. That's why it's hard to. But if you think Calamity Jane, that's
okay.
Yeah, that's right.
That'll stick with me. Calamity Jane. Her representation is perfect. I love every minute of it. I love the fast swinging from deeply sensitive, caring person to brutal, fist fighting, mind trash, you know? And it's like the fact that the last scene involves her trying to comfort a child saying, you know, row, row, row your boat. And then pause and looks at the other guy. Who's like, God damn it. Singing. It's so good.
Yeah. No. And one of the scenes that makes her character for me is tragic because it's when Swearingen comes in and she backs down and you know she's tougher than that, but she was not prepared for him. And it tells you two things. One is, you know, the volatility of Calamity Jane, but also just the raw evil of Swear Engine that makes him able to do the things he does.
He rides in entirely on presence because he never makes an overt threat. Like, his presence is all the threat he needs. And the implication of him being there is all the information she needs to be terrified and shut down and then immediately start beating herself up about it.
And that's a real reaction, you know? I've seen this episode twice now, and I'm taken every time by that. I think if there is anything that's bugging me about it, it's that what's his name, Seth,
yep.
Timothy Oliphant's character.
Yep.
Seth seemed a little bit more angry in this episode than I feel like it was warranted.
Well, again, we're in the early phases. They have to draw everyone as a cartoon before they can give them the nuance that they deserve. I think it was important to make it clear two episodes in a row that Seth is a righteous man who expects fair dealings from those around them. And so the first episode, we saw him come into the cesspool and hold his own. I think we needed to see him hit his limit and fail to break through when it came to dealing with Swearengen and to walk away angry and frustrated.
I mean, just Raylan wouldn't have lost his cool like that. That's all I'm saying. And I actually may be affecting my perception there too. Is, you know, I'm thinking of him as two characters sometimes.
I'll tell you what though, man, looking at the set design. And again, this is all stuff I didn't notice the first time around. Knowing that this came out at the same time as Firefly, knowing that this was on a premium cable network, HBO versus Fox for Firefly, the set design and the world is so much better in Deadwood. It's a fantastical world with Firefly, but I believe that all of that mud is manure and human feces and horrific stuff, right? Like, that whole world feels filthy and awful in a way that I didn't get, and I'm kind of glad that we watched Firefly back to back with it.
Yeah, I every time they play the Deadwood theme song, I feel like I'm a little bit in Firefly. And imagine
it's that violin that you hear?
Yeah. Can you imagine if Firefly got the Deadwood budget? Right, if they had swapped places.
I wonder what I would be really intrigued to know what the comparative budgets were between the two of them.
Yeah. For non-personnel, I would want to know the non-personnel budget, right? Because you could have budgets swing all kinds of ways because, well, you know, on broadcast TV, this actor gets this amount.
Right.
But like, what did they actually spend on the production side of it? I'd be curious too.
Yeah, I agree.
You're right. They did a great
regardless,
job.
Like, I am more excited in episode two for this revisit than I was in episode one. I am stoked.
Well, folks, hope you're having fun watching along with us, and you can keep us going. In fact, get us to 1850. That's not a year. That's an amount of people and or dollars. And we will be breaking up Spoiler in Time into bite-sized chunks so you can get to just the shows you want to watch along with us. We'll be your pals that'll come over anytime you want and watch a show with you.
Yeah, man. And it doesn't matter how much you guys donate. A dollar an episode. In fact, go ahead and make a dollar an episode and then cap your monthly pledge at a dollar an episode. Then it'll be like 25 cents per episode.
Yeah.
But more importantly, you'll join the 1,622 patrons to make us 1,623. Do it right now. If you're our friend, we'd do it for you.
Yeah. Head on over to patreon.com/cordkillers and we will spoil you next time.
XOXO.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.